Long before baseball games were broadcast on TV, there were baseball movies. A new DVD set from Kino International takes us back to some of the earlier days of our national pastime. It's called Real Baseball, Baseball Films from the Silent Era. Two features and 11 short silent films from the years 1899 to 1926, complete with newly composed music. And I'm very pleased to welcome the set's producer, Jessica Rosner, and composer Ben Modell to my show now to tell us about him. Hi.
Hello. Hi. Thanks for having me back.
So, Jessica, how did this project come about? Where did you find these films?
Those are my two passions, are silent film or early film and baseball. And I go to a lot of conventions where there are private collectors of prints, and I started hitting everybody up and asking what they had that was about baseball, and virtually none of them were baseball fans. And in the end, we got most of the material from private collectors and a few of the shorts from Library of Congress.
Well, you are a Cubs fan, and I guess there are no films about the Cubs here because there are no highlights in the history of the Cubs.
No, though ironically, when I was doing the project, I was desperate to find something earlier than 1908, the last time they won. And originally I didn't have it, and then somebody called up and said, well, I've got this short from 1906. And I thought, great, I have to have that, which is called How the Office Boy Saw the Ball Game. And the very last shot in the film shows a scoreboard, and the Cubs have beaten the Boston Braves in that film.
There are something like 100 silent films about baseball still extant. How did you wind up choosing these 13?
Well, some of it's practical. We couldn't do films that were still under studio copyright, which most people don't realize are most silent feature films.
Really? I thought that they entered public domain after a while.
No, they would not enter public domain if they were made in the year 1923 or after, and a lot of the more famous baseball features, Slide Kelly Slide, the later version of Casey at the Bat, and so on, were certainly under copyright, and also depends on access, where the material is. It was generally easier to deal with private collectors in the Library of Congress because other places and other archives, just the fees and difficulties of getting the material is astronomical, and we had a very small budget, obviously.
And I'm imagining that some of them were in rather poor shape because a lot of silent films were neglected.
Yeah, I mean, these were all prints that by now had been preserved into 16 or in some cases 35. The material varies. Ironically, the last film in this series, which is a very minor comedy called Happy Days, produced by an extremely obscure company called the Weiss Brothers, is in the best condition. It looks like it was made yesterday because their material, for some bizarre reason, survived because of a bankruptcy.
Well, most of these films feature some actual baseball, but they also have plots, often involving romance or dishonest characters trying to fix games. So was it thought at the time, do you know, that just watching a film of a whole game would be boring?
Well, I mean, there'd be newsreel footage of actual action. I don't think someone would film an entire game. But, you know, it was very common to take a sport or whatever was popular in the era and turn it into a movie plot.
Well, Ben, these wind up being like a lot of other silent films, except that baseball is part of them. So do you have to do you do anything different when you approach these?
Not really. What's nice is that baseball, the game of baseball, lends itself more than a lot of other sports really nicely to visual storytelling, as opposed to, you know, football, where there's a clump of guys running around. There's an organized structure, and everybody has a specific job. And so in the games you see in the films, there are different, you know, wide shots and close-ups of different people doing what they're supposed to do, and you can develop tension through cutting and editing. So it's not that much much different than the way I might approach anything else.
Although we, at least old-timers, associate the organ with baseball because most baseball teams had organists until fairly recently.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a way that theater organists could make either a complete living or a partial living, the way that many musicians were able to make a living during the silent era playing in picture houses. And when talkies came in, that line of work disappeared in the course of 1 or 2 years. So the organ is a sound that people heard at baseball games a great deal, and it's not something that people hear all that much with silent film, although it was a pretty typical sound of the silent era. And what's nice about the set that Jessica produced is that There, you do get to hear the theater organ quite a bit. Not just myself, but there's the score for Heading Home by David Knutson. Is that right?
David Knutson
did a very nice job.
So that was already attached to the film?
No. Dave lives up in Dakota. We're actually, as a friend of the gentleman who provided the material for the film, and he knew the film very well through his friend, and I think he recorded it at a theater.
Yeah, when you hear him, you're hearing an actual theater pipe organ.
Well, sometimes you use piano. So how did you determine which was which? Was there any way of knowing what the original scores had sounded like?
There might be, but often the music that was circulated was really there as a suggestion. The scores that were sent out were never enforced, and it was often up to the local organist or conductor or pianist to come up with their own music. If they couldn't read music, they had to improvise. And I've seen original cue sheets that were sent around where the local organist has crossed out half of the cues and written in their own ideas. And so now that I've begun doing more theater organ scoring, largely in part to a new computer program, it's a virtual theater organ called the Miditzer. It's a free download. I've been able to choose sort of anything sort of after 1920-ish theater organ when that sound became more prevalent, and anything earlier, anything before World War I, basically piano. So something like the film Jessica just mentioned, how the office boy saw the ball game, being an earlier film, I chose a piano for that, and something like Happy Days or Felix Saves the Day, I wound up using a theater organ.
And do you apply those same rules when you're working at the Museum of Modern Art?
Yeah. Basically, now again, because I have the Miditzer, where I can take a couple of keyboards and a laptop and take them with me in a cab, I don't have to install and, you know, uninstall a complete Wurlitzer every time I want to use it. So I now have that option. And during the Arbuckle series last year, I used it for most of the shows that I accompanied. And it's a great sound to bring back to silent film.
I'm talking with Ben Modell, who is responsible for most of the music in a new 2-DVD set called Real Baseball, R-E-E-L, Baseball. 2 features, 11 shorts, 2 DVDs from 1899 through 1926, and they're from Kino International. Also here is Jessica Rosner, who is the set's producer. And I guess we shouldn't be surprised that there are a couple of films here featuring Babe Ruth.
There's one feature film and a little – the only newsreel footage that's in this set. Everything else is fiction, but there's a little snip of Babe Ruth visiting a pottery factory or a potter.
Now, I never associated Babe Ruth with pottery.
Well, it's a little bit of film that a very nice man who has no interest in baseball, and he provided that, and the little Edison short The Casey at the Bat or The Fate of the Rotten Umpire, and it was just their two nice little snips. The feature, Heading Home, that was actually produced by the New York Yankees the year he came there.
And we see him chopping down trees and then whittling them into bats with the title, Babe Seemed to Know That 10 Cents Worth of Kindlingwood Would Make Him Famous One Day. He was born, I know from my research, at 216 Emory Street in southern Baltimore. But in the film, he's from some small town. So was that PR trying to present him as a small town boy? It made good rather than the hard living image that he was already developing in real life?
Well, it wasn't uncommon when the movies put a celebrity in that they would play against type. I mean, Ruth was essentially a juvenile delinquent who grew up in an orphanage and drank hard, and here he is in a small town with mom and literally apple pie. And one of the other films, One Touch of Nature, features the New York Giants manager, John McGraw, who is notoriously not a friendly man. And he's featured as a kindly, fatherly figure. So
nurturing his players.
Nurturing his players, which I think most of his players would not recognize had they seen the film. But again, people would play against type. I mean, I don't think they really wanted them to sort of – it wouldn't have been good PR for them to play that character.
But the Yankees, you say, were partly responsible for Heading Home. They already knew that they had something quite special on their hands.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he was a star by then. And, of course, the thing that shocks everyone about this film, which is 1920, is how thin Ruth is. He was not yet the big, bulky guy. He was, as my friend Rob Edelman, who did the liner notes, he was svelte. You know, he was almost good-looking.
The earliest film on the set is Casey at the Bat, or The Fate of a Rotten Umpire from 1899. What do we know about this film?
Well, it was a little Edison film that was shot on the front lawn of Thomas Edison's estate in New Jersey. And, you know, this was not uncommon. That's basically what was being made at that period. I mean, in fairness, there were films now that were certainly, you know, 10, 15, 20 minutes long, but these one-minute films that's a lot of what Edison was doing at the time. By 1906, How the Office Boy is about 6 minutes long. It's another Edison. So it's just kind of a fun, goofy little movie where the players get their revenge on the umpire.
And you've got to come up with something the equivalent of the minute walls for a film this year.
Yeah, yeah. Just as you're getting up to speed, the thing wraps up. So the trick is just to know, you know, watch the counter and know when it's wrapping up and just tidy it up and finish it really quick.
Some of these films are comedies, like Hearts and Diamonds, featuring John Bunny as a man who's trying to win the heart of a woman by becoming a baseball player. Was he a major star of his day?
He was a huge star.
He's wonderful.
He's wonderful. They just did a tribute to him. Well, they did a tribute to him at MoMA with the Vitagraphs. He was a very large man. Vitagraph was in Brooklyn, and that film is basically, you know, early Ebbets Field, I believe.
Yeah.
But he was great. He was a huge star. He died, I guess, about 2 years after this film was made. He was one of the biggest comedy stars. One of the other small films, The Ball Player and the Bandit, stars Harold Lockwood, who was, again, a huge star, who's virtually unknown now because he died in the 1918 flu epidemic.
So if you died before a certain year, you are not remembered as well as Charlie Chaplin or Buster Keaton? They live longer.
Yeah, they live longer. They had their films survived at a higher rate, for one thing. I think very few, I mean, a certain number of Bunny's films survived, but not a lot. And among the silent film people that I know, it was like, oh, my God, you've got a John Bunny baseball movie. I mean, we were all excited by just the thought of it.
And it's a delightful picture.
Do you approach the score to a comedy differently? I mean, other than, obviously, you don't have all the sentimental music.
Sure, unless it's warranted. Well, not too much differently. There's still, you try to find a story arc. There's a spot where a main theme can fit in three or maybe four times that you look for.
It's like writing a symphony.
Yeah, in a sense, using leitmotifs for a couple of either main story ideas or main characters. And this is a tradition that was taught to me by a guy named Lee Irwin, who was an organist who was playing for films in the 20s himself, and I met him when I started playing when I was in college, and he was an organist at the Carnegie Hall Cinema. So I don't think I approach it that much differently. And what's another nice thing that about the set is that there's a few of us on it, and there's a pianist from Chicago named Dave Drazen who did a wonderful score for
The Busher.
For The Busher, he did a really nice job, and so we all have our own styles.
The Busher starred Charles Ray and Colleen Moore,
and a very young John Gilbert.
Really?
Yeah.
And we also have a middle-aged Felix the Cat.
Well, I don't know if he's middle-aged. Oh, I think that's kind of early for Felix.
Yeah.
I just was
trying
to do a segue there.
Just giving us
1922, and that mixed live action with animation.
Yeah.
Already kind of common at that time, wasn't it?
I think it wasn't that rare. I mean,
yeah, it was done a great deal. Yeah, it was done a great deal with the Coco series that
right.
Fleischers were doing. It was unusual for Felix, so it's one of the things that makes it such an anomaly. But it's a fun short, and the location footage is delightful.
Do we know whether these films were popular at the time?
Well, I don't have box office records. You certainly wouldn't for the shorts. There was a lot of litigation involved in Head and Home, so it's really hard to tell what went on there since it was an independent production. I think The Busher was definitely popular. It boosted the career of Colleen Moore, who was just becoming a major star.
And
Charles
Ray
was a big star at that point. And he had made another baseball film 2 years earlier that was a big hit called The Pinch Hitter.
There was also this unusual film called His Last Game, starring Bill Going, who played for the Choctaw Indian team, and that almost gets political.
That's probably my favorite. It's just such a bizarre film. There's so much going on in this one little film. Indians gambling, the American West, executions, pardons from the governor, and a baseball game somewhere in between all of that. It's an amazing little film that was at the Library of Congress.
Also here is the only film in which we really hear a voice is Hedda Hopper's husband.
Well, they had been divorced by then. It was a famous matinee idol, DeWolf Hopper, and their son William Hopper was the guy on the Perry Mason show. But he had been doing this for almost since the poem was written, which I believe is 1896, or I think. And he had made a stage career out of this recitation. And then the Photophone Shorts filmed this. It was an experimental sound short done in 1922. And it's beyond bizarre. I mean, it's as if it was a horror film. My jaw just dropped to the floor watching this thing. I wish the quality of the material were better, but it's certainly the most bizarre thing there.
Now, there are a lot of baseball films from the sound era. Would you ever consider putting out some of them, like Rhubarb?
Unfortunately, virtually all of those, Rhubarb happens to be a favorite of mine. Those are all studio pictures, and you can't. It's very hard for a company like Kino to get a license for studio pictures. I would certainly hope the studios that own them would put them out, because Rhubarb is one of the better and lesser known ones.
And I like that one with Ray Milland where
it happens every spring. Yeah,
he develops some kind of chemical that prevents people from being able to hit his pitches. This group of films is called Real Baseballs, 1899 to 1926. It's from Kino International, and my great thanks to Ben Modell, who provided the music for many of the films, and also to Jessica Rosner, who put the whole thing together, for being on our show today.
Well, thank you
very
much.
Thank you very much.